Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Nearly 50,000 General Motors employees have gone on strike after union talks break down. About 49,000 General Motors employees walked off the job at 12 a.m. this morning after negotiations between the UAW, the United Auto Workers Union, and the Detroit-based car manufacturer have broken down. The union had announced plans for the nationwide strike Sunday afternoon. No deal was reached before the midnight deadline. It's the first national UAW strike since 2007. Well, what are the issues that have brought the workers to this point, and what are the long-term implications? For this, we turn to my first guest, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Dr. Linwood Taheed. Linwood, welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
We're also joined by the director of the Labor Institute in New York. He's working with unions, worker centers, and community organizations to build a national economics education campaign. Les Leopold, Les, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me.
So, Linwood, let me start with you. I know these things just don't occur overnight, but this one did not really seem to be on a lot of people's radar.
I think that's true. You know, we're getting in the news every day how wonderful this economy is, how wonderful the job market is. And so, you know, no one would expect perhaps a major strike to occur when the economy is doing well. It's, you know, people might wonder, you know, if the economy is doing so well, why are the United Auto workers so disgruntled or disgruntled enough to strike? So I think it probably in this atmosphere of promotion of the Trump economy, people may be surprised.
Les, same point to you. And to follow up on Linwood's point, the president is, you know, supposed to be bringing all of these manufacturing jobs back to the country. The economy is just booming like gangbusters. Everybody is just supposed to be walking around with money falling out of their pockets, full stomachs, and smiles on their faces. What's going on, Les?
Well, the economy is booming for the top 1%, and the everybody else more or less hasn't had a raise in 40 years when you take into account inflation. But let me go back and give you some background, if I could.
Please.
About General Motors. In 2007, General Motors was in, during the crash, General Motors was caught without a cash supply, and it was about to go into bankruptcy. And the U.S. government came to its rescue. But part of the rescue, like $50 billion worth of guaranteed loans, part of the rescue package was that the workers had to accept pretty dramatic cuts in wages and benefits. And the interesting part of the story is one of the guys that was working on this bailout plan for the Obama administration, a guy named Harry Wilson, who got trained at our expense to learn all about GM. As soon as the settlement took place, he understood that GM was going to get back on its feet again. He went and set up a group of kind of hedge funds to go in and buy up a lot of GM stock. And then as soon as GM had a cash surplus, he demanded and received a stock buyback, which is basically what we call financial strip mining, taking the money out of GM while the workers were sacrificing, taking the money out of GM, which all of us thought was going to go to reinvestment in the latest efficient cars, green cars, et cetera. That money went to Wall Street and to the top CEOs who get most of their pay in terms of stock. And a stock buyback raises the price of the stock. This is the preferred way for the way corporations and financial entities move money from corporations to their pockets. Since then, GM has now announced up to $20 billion of stock buybacks. And that's why the union and the workers are so upset. They're making sacrifices, and GM is saying, oh, we need you need to pay more of your own health care costs. You need to pay, we can't give you, you know, we can't be as generous as we once were because we need the money for reinvestment. No, they don't need the money for reinvestment. They need the money to satisfy the top executives and the hedge funds who own large chunks of stock. That's what's pushing this strike, and it's happening. Fortunately, there's a union here that can mobilize against it, but it's happening in corporations all over the country. One last example. I'm sorry to hog the airtime here, but you mentioned Trump. The Trump tax cut was supposed to $1 trillion, right? Was supposed to lead to, he said, an average increase in workers' pay of about $4,000 a year per worker. That's what he said was going to happen. Well, we've done the analysis since up until last January, and of that trillion something dollars, $7 billion has gone to one-time bonuses and wage increases, and $7 billion, over $1 trillion of that has gone to stock buybacks, not new investment in plant and equipment, not new jobs, stock buybacks. That's the nature of our economy now, and I'm very happy that the workers there are actually attempting to do something about it. I just wish that we could get this into the press a little bit more so that we could focus on this financial strip mining.
Linwood, to Les's point about financial strip mining, as well as the most recent drone attacks in Saudi Arabia, which many are projecting could cause a 20 to 25 cent increase in the price of gas. GM and other U.S. manufacturers were shifting, I believe, some of their product mix away from smaller cars to trucks and SUVs. We're also looking at, it's being projected, that there's going to be a recession on the horizon. So there seem to be a number of factors, independent factors, but they all seem to be coming together to make this tough on the auto industry.
I think that's correct. I want to get back to a point that Les made and tie this in. Les made the point about the increasing amount of stock buybacks that have been happening, particularly since the 2008 financial crisis. One of the things that we know is that most of the last year's decrease in corporate taxation was intended by corporations to be used to buy back stock. Now, what buying back stock does is increases the demand for a company's stock, which artificially raises the price. It keeps the price up. And so when that happens, we see that Wall Street, the Dow, and so forth, starts to rise. It's not a sustainable rise, as we can see, because the money for investment for stock buybacks goes away after you purchase the stock.
The same way the tax breaks have gone away, and that's slowing the economy.
Exactly. So the economy is slowing, and so what the Trump administration is proposing is another round of corporate tax cuts, knowing that these corporate tax cuts will again be used for stock buybacks, which will amp up Wall Street, but won't do anything on Main Street. And so while Wall Street and the top earners, the top 1%, are doing well, even the top 10% are doing quite well, Main Streeters are seeing a job market in which they can acquire all of the part-time jobs they want. I mean, if you're out of work now, you can go to Uber tomorrow. In the next hour, you can go to work for Uber. So you can have a job. You can be considered employed. But that's not employment that's going to give you any kind of quality of life that you want. And so unemployment rates are down because of the increase in part-time work. Stock market is booming, and many people don't understand the disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street that makes it look as if the economy is doing well on paper, but down on the street where ordinary people live. And where, for example, GM auto workers live, things are not doing very well. There's this huge increase in health care costs that GM workers are being asked to absorb. And since about 1970, there's been about a 500% increase in health care costs. But also since 1970, there's been really no increase, actually a negative effect on real wages of workers.
And as Linwood, you and I have talked about before with Jack Rasmus and others, we just put it simply, the economy is booming, but the quality of life for the average individual, even middle class individual in this country, has not gotten any better. We only have about a minute left for both of you to answer this. I'm going to come to you, Les, and ask you, do you have any sense of how long of a strike this could be? Are the GM workers really prepared to go to the mat on this one? And what if it is a prolonged strike, what kind of impact do you see this having? We'll go to you, Les Leopold, and then Linwood, I'll get you to answer the same question.
These things are tough to predict, but mm-hmm. If I were to put money on it, I don't think it's going to be a long strike. I think GM has plenty of cash reserves to satisfy the need. If you look at the analyst's report mm-hmm. on this, they're basically saying, buy the GM stock now. It's depressed. You know, go get it. It's not going to be a long strike. That would be my guess.
Okay.
But I'd like to say one last thing, and I would like you and Linwood to join our runawayinequality.org education campaign. We need people like you. You're extremely clear, knowledgeable people, and we need to get this word out all over the country.
I'll reach out to you, Les. And Linwood, real quick to you.
I think I agree with Les. I'll defer to his knowledge of these specific issues. GM has lots of money, so there's no reason for them to play, or at least attempt to play hardball. They can't hide the fact that they've had record profits.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you so much for that insight and analysis. Greatly appreciate it. Look forward to having the both of you back. Dr. Linwood Taheed, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Associate Professor of Economics, Les Leopold as well. Thank you so much. Look forward, Les, to getting you back. All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Purdue Pharma files for bankruptcy as the lawsuits related to its links to the opioid epidemic continue to grow. The embattled drug manufacturer that is accused of triggering the nation's epidemic of opioid addiction through its sale of the profitable but highly addictive painkiller OxyContin filed for bankruptcy Sunday. Will the Chapter 11 filing lead to the ultimate demise of the company? And how much of the personal fortunes of the billionaire Sackler family, which owns Purdue, will be available to compensate plaintiffs? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She's a medical doctor and co-director of Popular Resistance, Dr. Margaret Flowers. Margaret, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thank you for inviting me.
So what is your take on this now moving out of federal court into federal bankruptcy court?
Well, I think all along this has been designed to protect the Sackler family, and what we're learning is that they may have moved some money out of the business in order to make it weaker financially so that they could go into bankruptcy, but this doesn't mean the end of their ability to make OxyContin and sell it. They're going to restructure according to their plan and continue to make and sell OxyContin. So this is really not what we would consider to be justice or to be fair. We're talking about a family that has made billions of dollars from aggressively marketing, lying about their product, and it has led to hundreds of thousands of deaths and many more lives shattered, people addicted. So we need to see some more, I think, and definitely some personal accountability in this situation.
Now, one of the things that I read in terms of the company, Purdue Pharma, being able to continue to sell OxyContin is the statement that the Sackler family would not profit from the sale of that drug.
Yeah, I understand they're talking about some sort of a trust arrangement, but why this, family would continue to be involved in the making and selling of OxyContin after their behavior is just mind-boggling.
As a physician, talk a bit about the problems that this has really created, and the fact that from everything that I've read, this is really, and I hope I'm not being too simplistic here, it's a marketing problem. It's the fact that Purdue Pharma created this product and then intentionally marketed the product in a way so that physicians would continue to prescribe it, even though people have been quickly getting hooked on it.
Right. And this is kind of just an example of the fundamental problems with our current healthcare system, which treats healthcare as a product, not as a right or a public good. And so we see a situation in which pharmaceutical corporations, and Purdue Pharma is certainly not the only one, market their drugs very aggressively. They go to individual physician offices. They give them information about their product. They tell them this is, you know, how it works, et cetera. They actually monitor physicians' prescribing habits, and they may contact them and pressure them if they're not prescribing enough. And physicians who are busy practicing and burdened by a tremendous amount of paperwork in this system that we've created, that don't have a good source of information on these things, don't have an independent source of information. And so doctors were led to believe in the late 90s and going forward that OxyContin was a great alternative, that it was, you know, low addiction properties. And so they were pushed to prescribe it. But on top of that, we're also seeing that, you know, Purdue Pharma and others were dumping tremendous amounts of these medications into communities, particularly vulnerable communities like in West Virginia and Ohio. And we're not monitoring the fact that these kind of pain pill clinics were, you know, being set up where people could get large amounts of these drugs without necessarily, you know, being indicated. So it's really, this is, you know, just an example of why healthcare should not be treated as something on the market, because they basically lied, acted against the interests of people, also that they could make a profit, and it has been a cost of human lives and great suffering.
To your point about dumping pills into vulnerable communities, I remember watching, I want to say sometime last year, might have been later, Senator Bernie Sanders did a town hall from West Virginia. And one of the things that came out of this town during this town hall was the government of West Virginia made itself available for to build private prisons in West Virginia under the pretext of creating jobs for unemployed coal miners and others in the region. But what they found was West Virginians could not get the jobs at the private prisons because they couldn't pass the drug tests because so many of those individuals were hooked on OxyContin.
Yeah, Chris Hedges wrote about this in one of his previous books, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, and, you know, where he spent some time in West Virginia, and just the great poverty there, the environmental devastation, these, you know, destroyed communities. There are tremendous amounts of drug use in West Virginia and other, you know, destroyed areas of the United States.
The Sacklers, who control Purdue, they have offered in the settlement, they've offered $3 billion in cash, an additional $1.5 billion or more through the eventual sale of other companies that they own. And but as I understand, as you talked about early in this conversation, they've stashed a lot of cash outside the country. And so the question really, one of the big questions really becomes, how much of that, if any of that money, will the government be able to get its hands on to settle more than 2,600 lawsuits that are alleging that Purdue Pharma helped to fuel the U.S. opioid epidemic?
Right. And I think overall the settlement is about $10 or $12 billion. The Sackler family, it's estimated, is worth about $13 billion. So they're being required to give out $3 billion of their own dollars, but that still leaves them extremely wealthy. So, and then in addition to that, I understand that there are still cases outstanding because local governments have sued as well. And so who knows what could come, you know, down the road. This may not be the end of it, but certainly what we're seeing right now is kind of the typical corporate behavior where they set it up so that they can try to protect their assets as much as possible and continue to go on with business as usual.
I think to your point, about two dozen states are still opposed, or they, at least they haven't signed on to the settlement. And you've got thousands of cities and counties along with those states that have sued Purdue. And then, of course, you've got individual suits that are pending. This could take an incredible amount of time to go through the system. As a physician yourself and looking at pain management, does this really speak to American medicine and the influence of lobbyists and pharmaceutical companies on the delivery of good medicine in this country?
Well, I mean, the pain business has become a big business, and that's really a shame. And it's why we need to get the profit out of our healthcare system, because there are patients who legitimately have pain and who legitimately need pain management, but our system is not really set up in their best interest. You know, the typical doctors get a very little bit of time with their patients. They don't have time to see them and manage them as they may, you know, need multiple visits if they're using pain medicines to monitor and make sure they're not getting addicted, to take steps to protect them from addiction or wean them off if they're starting to develop withdrawal symptoms. So our whole healthcare system is not really designed around health. And because it's become such a big business, yes, you see all kinds of lobbying influence from private hospitals, private pharmaceutical companies, you know, health insurance industries. They're all trying to get their piece of what is, you know, a very large part of our GDP, the healthcare system.
At the end of the day, do you really see those who have been most egregiously affected by the actions and the marketing of the Sackler family, are they going to get justice?
Well, the, you know, 200,000 people that have died from opioid overdoses related to this are not going to get justice. I think that what is going to be needed is going to be a lot more than the $10 or $12 billion that they're talking about. There needs to be public education. There needs to be physician education. There needs to be treatment on demand for people who are addicted to these now. So I think that this is a huge problem, and it's going to take a lot more resources than what's just coming out of this case.
Dr. Margaret Flowers, physician and co-director of Popular Resistance, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your flexibility, and look forward to having you back.
Thank you.
All right, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, Secretary of State Pompeo blames Iran for a drone attack on Saudi oil industry. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo blamed Iran for a series of attacks on a massive Saudi Aramco oil facility, saying there was no evidence the drones originated in Yemen, as Tehran-backed rebels are claiming. Iran denied responsibility for the raids Saturday, which forced Saudi Arabia to slash its daily oil output in half. President Trump said Sunday that the United States was prepared to respond to the devastating attacks on two oil installations in Saudi Arabia that have halved the state oil company's production output, while Iran again rejected the U.S. accusations. Quote, "There is reason to believe that we know the culprit," Trump said in a tweet Sunday evening. He said the United States was locked and loaded, depending on verification. Is Pompeo trying to lure us into a war with Iran similar to the one we've already gone through with Iraq? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's an international affairs and security analyst, Mark Sloboda. Mark, as always, welcome back.
Dr. Leon, thanks for having me on. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on The Critical Hour.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you. So we get the reports, I guess, late Saturday, early Sunday, about drones launched by Yemen striking this Saudi oil field. Pompeo then comes and says, well, Iran did it. we don't have any evidence to say that Yemen did it, but he hasn't presented any evidence to say that Iran did it. So help me out here.
Yeah, the way the burden of proof works is usually when you make an accusation, particularly in the face of someone else claiming to have done it, you present evidence to the contrary. That doesn't quite work that way with the U.S. government. They've never had quite that relationship with evidence and responsibility, many times to our detriment before, all the way back to Iraq and claims of weapons of mass destruction, not to mention Libya and Syria and so on. The situation is that this was a sophisticated drone attack on these Saudi oil processing facilities. In particular, there were 17 strikes that we know of on the main facility. There was a secondary attack on Saudi Arabia's second largest oil processing facility, but we don't have images or detailed information about that strike yet. But these 17 strikes, they're specifically targeted to take out stabilization process that would prepare the oil, the crude oil pumped from Saudi Arabia for shipping. This required probably months of research and very specific planning. It doesn't necessarily mean that the weapons themselves were very sophisticated. In fact, to the contrary, they don't seem to have been incredibly sophisticated, but the planning and the targeting that went into it, rather than necessarily attacks from Iraq, it seems more than likely that at least part of the attack originated from within Saudi Arabia itself. That is certainly something that the Saudi dictatorship does not want to shine a light on. Principally, the Saudi regime is always in a state of constant low-level warfare with its restive Shia minority in the south of the country, which is one of the reasons why they began the invasion of Yemen, because they didn't want to see a demonstrative effect of a Houthi, a former religious student movement, bleeding over across their border and inciting their Shia minority to demanding more rights or, God forbid, separatism or something like that.
I can think of there are two real, to me, simple reasons why the United States government would not accept Yemen's taking responsibility, the Houthis taking responsibility for this. One would be because the Pompeos of the world are trying every trick they can to get us to go against Iran. And the other is the Saudis, I would think, do not want to give credit to the Houthis for being now a much more formidable force than we've been led to believe up to this point.
Absolutely. I mean, Yemen is the single poorest country in the world. That's it. And Saudi Arabia is now the third largest arms spender in the world. There's the United States, China, and then Saudi Arabia, and then only fourth is Russia. Saudi Arabia is the third biggest arms spender in the world, buying most of their sophisticated arms from the United States, United Kingdom, France, Germany, and other Western countries. They have on paper, a very expensive military, but it hasn't fared very well in Yemen. They are on the verge of losing this war, especially with their former partners, Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, pulling out on them, with the United Arab Emirates even supporting southern separatists against them in Yemen now. The war in Yemen is not going very well. The invasion hasn't netted any rewards for Saudi Arabia. It's cost them large amounts of money and political capital, and really embarrassed their military capability. And part of the framing that is always used to justify the Saudi invasion and the U.S. and United Kingdom support for it is that they're not there. It's not about Yemen per se. It's not about putting their puppet Hadi back on the throne in Yemen. It's because Iran is supporting the Houthis. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that first, Iran's Shias are actually of quite a different religious school, Shia school, as it were, from the Houthis. But even most American Yemenis experts, not that there's so very many of those, but such that I've read of them, all of their assessment have said that the evidence of Iranian support for the Houthis is extremely light and is at best exaggerated. Again, this, I think, has far more to do with Saudi's problems with its own rest of Shia minority just across the border from Yemen, and this, you know, of course, being tribal peoples, they don't quite recognize the solidity and reality of modern state line borders the way the governments in the West respect them to. Plus, we all know that since they took office, the Trump administration has had a bit of a hard on for conflict with Iran. Every time the Houthis have carried out a successful attack in retaliation against the Saudi dictatorship that is invading them in Saudi Arabia, the blame has gone not on the Houthis for retaliating in a war, but against Iran. And that justifies, in the way it's presented, at least, the Saudi invasion of Yemen and the U.S. support for that invasion.
I don't like drawing parallels of this nature, but I think there would be a lot of people listening to this program that would be asking themselves, could the Saudi invasion of Yemen become Saudi Arabia's Vietnam? Are there any parallels to be drawn between those two fiascos?
Sure. I'm not quite sure about a body count total. Saudi Arabia has been very tight-lipped about that. Plus, they prefer to use Yemenis forces, local Yemenis forces as their proxies. They've hired mercenaries from around the world. They'd rather everyone do the fighting, of course, other than, their own military. And they've kept what losses they've had very, very tight to the chest. So I can't make a proper assessment there, but certainly it has caused a huge morale loss.
Right.
It has caused a loss of political capital and prestige.
That's where I was. That's where I was
crown prince in waiting, Mohammed bin Salman. I mean, he's fresh off of, he was instrumental in the situation in Libya, the results of which have not turned out well, at least in the aftermath for Saudi's involvement in that conflict. Syria has been a failure, and Yemen is perhaps the biggest failure, not to mention the political damage of the whole Khashoggi affair with this former Saudi intelligence asset / Washington Post journalist, evidently carved up with a bone saw in a Saudi consulate in Turkey, and with Mohammed bin Salman directly implicated. And all of this is not reflecting well on the waiting crown prince and his ability to lead the country, particularly when his father finally passes from this world.
The Wall Street Journal had reported that Saudi and U.S. officials are investigating the possibility that cruise missiles were launched from Iraq, which is that just another log to throw on this fire of looking elsewhere instead of looking into Yemen? Is there any evidence to this?
There is evidence that missiles were used as well as suicide drones during the attack. Where exactly these missiles were fired from is a point of question. The missiles, for the information I've seen, are of a type that the Houthis have used and have basically have been produced in Yemen. But the U.S., again, these anonymous officials, no one wants to put their name out there. These anonymous U.S. officials are claiming that there have been upgrades, however, to these missiles that they use to justify their claims that Iran must have been involved. But the reality is that whether these attacks came from the south or, you know, across the Gulf there, is that Saudi Arabia does not have the air defense capability to defend their fragile and vulnerable and extremely important oil infrastructure from attacks like this. And this is kind of inevitable blowback. If the U.S. Were to engage in an actual armed conflict with Iran, which Saudi Arabia would be partners with at least at some level. Certainly politically, they're behind a lot of, both the Saudi and the Israeli governments pushing the U.S. to conflict with Iran. But there would be retaliatory attacks of an even greater, a factorial scale against these, very fragile Saudi infrastructure. And I think they're having an eye blinking moment where they're saying, are we really ready for this? Because if the Houthis could do this, if they are the ones responsible, then Iran would be capable of far, far more damage to Saudi Arabia's economic and their military infrastructure.
So on the one hand, we have the president saying that the United States is locked and loaded, depending on verification. So there are a couple of, I see that as a conflict. You've got Pompeo saying Iran did it. Then you've got the president saying we're locked and loaded, depending on verification. So either they did it and you have evidence, or they didn't do it, or whatever. And then you have this conflict or this miscue with the president saying that he'll sit down with the Iranians and talk with no preconditions. And then you have him saying, that's all just you have Mnuchin saying the same thing. You've got Pompeo, and then you've got the president saying, I never said that.
Yeah, and all of this, of course, is on the back of John Bolton being fired.
Which was the next point I was going to make. Go ahead.
With some reports suggesting that he was fired because of his constant pushing Trump to conflict with Iran and his anger that Trump might consider talking to or possibly even lightening this U.S. Unilateral illegal sanctions against Iran. One of the things I found most interesting about Trump's claims is he says in his tweets and comments that the world's oil supply, the world's oil production came under attack. And I'm like, the world has had problems with its oil supply in part because the U.S. has pulled out of the JCPOA unilaterally and leveled sanctions against Iran and against any country that wants to purchase oil from Iran, stopping Iranian oil from getting to the market. The same thing with their quest for regime change in Venezuela, stopping Venezuelan oil getting on the world's market. They're sitting on all of Syria's oil in East Syria, in their military occupation of East Syria, preventing that oil from getting to the world's market. And now they're you know, after stopping Iran from bringing their oil to the world, they're worried suddenly about Saudi Arabia's oil getting to the market. Well, if it wasn't for the Saudi invasion and this on one hand, or you know, the tensions with Iran on the other, we wouldn't be at this point where we see oil prices skyrocketing, which is, while good for the Russian economy, is not good for the U.S. economy. And it must be pointed out that the U.S. is under no obligation, that we have no mutual treaties or defense pacts with the Saudi dictatorship that necessitates that we have to play their defender. This is a conflict. It's inevitable blowback of their own making. And it is really unfortunate that we have an administration that feels they need to get involved and put American boys and girls in uniform at risk in defense of this blood-soaked, horrible Saudi dictatorship.
Final question. We have just about a minute. It's interesting that Pompeo is trying to blame Iran here when the Houthis have said, hey, we're not done. They've threatened additional attacks on Saudi oil installations. And so if Iran was responsible and the Houthis weren't, the Houthis are saying, hey, we're not finished.
Yeah, and that also ignores, of course, previous Houthi attacks. There have been attacks at Saudi airports and numerous other facilities within Saudi Arabia that clearly were worked. The work of the Houthis, again, in retaliatory attacks for the Saudi invasion of their own country. But the U.S. is completely ignoring what not only what has happened and the ones who are saying, hey, we were the ones responsible and this is why we did it. And this is what you have to do to stop it, or we are going to continue striking back against the country that is invading us.
And I remember, and I got to get out here, I remember a couple of weeks ago talking about stories and reports that the Houthis were about to start employing the use of drones. So it's not a mystery here. It's just more U.S. Misinformation, disinformation, and propaganda. Mark Sloboda, as always, Mark, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate your contribution to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you back.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, fears of military conflict between Venezuela and Colombia as tensions over Maduro government escalate. The U.S.-led effort to force Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro from office has moved into a new stage, with rising fears of military conflict between Venezuela and Colombia and the activation of a 70-year-old mutual defense treaty among countries of the Western Hemisphere. Members of the Inter-American Treaty of Reciprocal Assistance agreed last week to invoke the 1947 pact, better known as the Rio Treaty, that allows joint actions ranging from economic sanctions to the use of military force in cutting transport and communication links. Foreign ministers of the treaty's 19 member nations are due to meet later this month to decide which measures are necessary to stem the threat. Is this really going to result in military conflict? And what also is going on right now on the ground in Venezuela? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He is a political analyst and editor at Venezuelan Analysis. He is Ricardo Vaz, and he joins us from Caracas. Ricardo, as always, welcome back.
Hi, Wilmer. Thanks for having me again.
So is there really a conflict going on right now between Venezuela and Colombia, and how tense of a conflict or extensive of a conflict is this?
The short answer is no. I mean, there is, as you said in the introduction, there is growing tension, and this goes back a couple of weeks. But I don't think we are on the verge of a conflict, and also this reciprocal assistance treaty, even though it does open the door for these kinds of actions, it's also not something that's imminent. In fact, this was discussed in a recent meeting of the Organization of American States, and what was approved was the convening of the consultations body of this treaty, something like this. And then if you saw the comments later on by the State Department, for example, they talked about a new phase of concerted pressure, things like this. I mean, it can just mean more sanctions or the other countries applying sanctions to Venezuela, not necessarily moving towards a military dimension of this attempt to remove the Maduro government, even though that language is there. So whether it's, I think at this point it's more leverage and, hardening the stance than an imminent threat of a conflict breaking out. On the Venezuelan side, what has happened is that there have been, in the past several months, a few cases where Venezuelan intelligence services have allegedly dismantled terrorist initiatives, plans to bomb public buildings and, assassinate high-ranking figures and so on. And in all these cases, usually, and the source of information is some member of the plot that they arrest here in Venezuela, who then reveals the more or less the extension. And in all those cases, they kind of go back to some paramilitary efforts being hatched in Colombia. So the Venezuelan government has warned time and again that there may be a kind of a false flag episode being hatched in Colombia that would kind of trigger a foreign military intervention. And the U.S., when this tension broke out, came out very clearly saying that they would 100% back Colombia in any kind of confrontation.
Colombia is charged that President Maduro is hosting and arming Colombian guerrillas who have threatened to reignite a terrorist campaign. So you're talking about the Maduro government exposing and dealing with guerrilla threats in Venezuela, but now you've got Colombia allegedly charging him with the same tactic.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that's expressed very matter-of-factly in this Washington Post piece.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, this is a case of the media trying to do this guilt by association tactic.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
We've heard lots of times in recent months and years that the ELN, the National Liberation Army from Colombia, that it is based in Venezuela and that it has extensive operations in Venezuela, and that's never been actually proven. I mean, there are signs that there is presence here, but in the sense that there are many areas where there are illegal activities, there's smuggling and so on, and either the ELN itself or members of it are engaged in it, as are other irregular groups, things like gold mining in the south of the country. The other thing that the piece mentioned about the FARC guerrillas rearming, I mean, that has nothing to do with Venezuela. I mean, that has simply due to the fact that the Colombian government has not implemented the peace agreements, and not only has it not implemented the peace agreements, but the rate at which social leaders have been killed ever since the peace accords is higher than before. So, it's absurd to try and pin any responsibility for that on Venezuela.
You have just gotten back to Caracas, and I asked you before we started the interview about what's going on the ground. Are things stable? And you mentioned that there's some additional interesting developments. What's going on?
Yeah, so the situation on the ground is stable. I mean, at least in political terms, it's stable. And Juan Guaido keeps doing these rallies once a week, and he has 50 people show up, and so not much is happening on that front. But now, last night, the opposition released a statement saying that they were, effectively moving away from this dialogue process that there was going on with the government that was mediated by Norway. They decided that they were no longer taking part. And then today, the Venezuelan government announced an agreement. They called it a national dialogue agreement with other opposition parties, smaller opposition parties, that has some actually very wide-reaching agreements. For example, they are nominating new electoral authorities, which suggests that there may be elections in the near horizon. They are also reincorporating the Socialist Party into the National Assembly. They had left when the National Assembly went into this dispute with the Supreme Court. They're also proposing some kind of oil for food deals. It's not clear to whom they're proposing that. And also some other stuff about, unequivocally rejecting sanctions and so on. And so on one side, you have the Venezuelan opposition kind of hardening their stance, stepping away from dialogue, and also referring to this military treaty that we had been discussing before. And on the other, you have the government kind of reaching out to smaller opposition parties to try and build some kind of national consensus around some very basic things like, finding immediate solutions for the crisis, rejecting sanctions, and so on.
You had mentioned that prices were rising, and is that causing additional tension?
Yeah, I mean, it's always looming, So Venezuela had, depending on who measures it, had some 14 months of hyperinflation. So that's inflation above 50% every month. And then that was stopped in February. I mean, it was stopped not in a way that I would agree. I mean, they stopped it by basically contracting demand and freezing salaries. But, effectively, they had 5 months with inflation, not ideal, but at least under control. And then in August, it went back over 50%. So I don't know if that was some consequence of some fluctuations in the economy, or if we're actually going back to this roller coaster. It remains to be seen.
You mentioned that the government, the Maduro government, has been reaching out to smaller parties, has been making offers. Do you see that as the consolidation of political power? And if elections are looming or elections are possible in the near future, how do you think the Maduro government comes out if elections are held?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big question. So the elections, the most probable elections to take place are elections for the National Assembly. So the National Assembly is due to end its term in December 2020. And the Constitution stipulates that the elections need to be held at some point during the year. And so at this point, with the opposition, the Guaido opposition, first they were divided whether they would engage in dialogue or not. They will certainly be divided as to whether they take part in elections or not. And so the government might look to press its advantage, have elections. We're talking about as early as January, and kind of regain control of the National Assembly. I mean, they're reaching out to the opposition. I mean, these opposition parties that they've reached out to, let's be clear, I mean, they're very small. They don't really hold any power. They don't have any leverage. They don't represent a whole lot of people. But it allows them to create, not create, but at least have this idea that they are reaching out to people who do not agree with them, and who at least agree on this idea that, there is a problem. Sanctions are not the solution, and so we need to find some kind of political understanding as to move forward from here. So they're trying to create a new kind of political climate of some sanity to move forward.
Understanding that elections are pending, do you see the possibility here that the United States government is operating this as the calm before the storm, that there could be a significant uptick in American intervention, whether it be subtly or whether it be not so subtly, understanding that trying to change or create a climate that will be conducive to the opposition as opposed to the established government? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, I understand. I mean, the recent past has given us clear signs. I mean, after the elections for the Constituent Assembly in 2017, you had perhaps the most significant sanctions imposed, up to that point. Then after the presidential elections in 2018, you had again another round of very harsh sanctions. But, we're getting to a point where there will be nothing left to sanction. So I think the next few weeks are going to be crucial, because we need to see how this unfolds, whether this kind of new agreement on the ground can force Guaido's opposition to re-engage in dialogue. I don't know. We have to see how the how the U.S. government is going to react. You have to see whether elections are going to be announced and how all these actors are going to position themselves, because in the past, the opposition, I mean, now it forces us to distinguish between the, you know, the small opposition and the mainstream opposition. The mainstream opposition has been very intransigent in their decision not to take part, and that has cost them politically. So
you mentioned Juan Guaido's name. If the United States were to try to influence the elections, do you see the United States still putting their money or backing Juan Guaido, or is he deemed a failure and now they got to find somebody else?
Well, actually, that's probably a very big dilemma right now in Washington, because Guaido, not only a failure, he's becoming an embarrassment. Last week, there were pictures that surfaced. I don't know if you saw, there were pictures that surfaced of Guaido with some very, very unfriendly characters in Colombia, some paramilitary leaders that allegedly were the ones who took him across the border in February when they had this attempt to bring humanitarian aid, you know, quote unquote, across the border.
Mm-hmm.
Guaido was allegedly aided by these people who supposedly run drug trade. They have chop houses. They assassinate social leaders, and he's posing publicly for pictures with them. It's not a very good look, to say the least.
Wow. And final question to you. Looking at the election and hyperinflation, I would think that the United States would try to exacerbate the situation, the inflation, when the hyperinflation, as we get closer to an election, ratcheting up the sanctions, trying to put more pressure on the people, thinking that that's going to drive the people away from the government.
Yeah, that's always been the case. I mean, if you look at the, if you plot prices over time, you'll see spikes, and you can guess, you know, that's when elections took place. The U.S. has already been trying to block the shipments of food from arriving to Venezuela. It has imposed sanctions on shipping companies. So, yeah, I think it's very predictable that if an election does take place and the opposition, the mainstream opposition, does not take part, that they will try to ratchet up pressure as much as possible. And, you know, we have to see what kind of pressure that will be.
Ricardo Vaz, as always, thank you so much for your time. Political analyst and editor at Venezuelan Analysis. Ricardo, be safe. Appreciate you. Look forward to having you back.
My pleasure. Take care.
All right, folks, you have been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.